From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear a new conversation with Vermont author John Clinch. His new novel titled Marley is published by Atria. John Clinch's first novel, Finn, The Secret History of Huckleberry Finn's Father, was named an American Library Association notable book and was chosen as one of the year's best books by the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and the Christian Science Monitor. It won the Philadelphia Athenaeum Literary Award and was shortlisted for the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize. His second novel, Kings of the Earth, about which I interviewed him at the time, was named a best book of the year by the Washington Post and led the 2010 summer reading list at O, the Oprah magazine. In 2008, he organized a benefit reading for the financially ailing Twain House, an event that literally saved the house from bankruptcy. He's a native of upstate New York, and John lives with his wife in the Green Mountains of Vermont. Marley was dead to begin with, Charles Dickens tells us at the beginning of A Christmas Carol. But in John Clinch's new novel, Jacob Marley, business partner to Ebenezer Scrooge, is very much alive, a rapacious and cunning boy who grows up to be a forger, a scoundrel, and the man who will be both the making and the undoing of Scrooge. They meet as youths in the gloomy confines of Professor Drabb's Academy for Boys, where Marley begins their twisted friendship by initiating the innocent Scrooge into the gentle art of extortion. Years later, in the dank heart of London, their shared ambition manifests itself in a fledgling shipping empire. Between Marley's genius for deception and Scrooge's brilliance with numbers, they amass a considerable fortune of dubious legality, all rooted in a pitiless commitment to the soon-to-be-outlawed slave trade. When I spoke with John Clinch, I began by saying how much I admired this book. I found it unique from, if related to, A Christmas Carol, and I asked him as he worked if it took on a life of its own. That's where we begin. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The difficulty of Marley is that it's going to seem like it's a Christmas book to anybody who doesn't know anything about it.
Right.
And they'll think, this is some kind of a companion piece, and it will be of a piece in some way with the Dickens. And it is of a piece, but it's an entirely different animal.
It is.
It's in fact, when Atria, my publisher, first acquired the book, and they made a real run at getting it out in a hurry, actually. They acquired it the day before Thanksgiving of last year, of 2018, and it was out on October 8th of this year, which, as you know, is a pretty short cycle.
Yeah.
Because books, fiction takes generally a year, sometimes more. Their first thought was, in fact, to put it out after Christmas, as sort of because it is in some ways an anti-Christmas carol, and then they came to their senses and realized that the better thing to do would be to get it out way ahead of Christmas if we could. So that's why it came out in October. Although it's been kind of interesting to me to watch. It came out on October 8th. The New York Times Book Review issued their review of it on October 8th online.
Okay.
But it will not be reviewed in the paper in the Sunday Times Book Review section until December 8th.
That's great.
Yeah. You know what? So I think in some ways that's kind of a favor. They did me they did the book the kindness of reviewing it on the day that it was published, which was good. But certainly a lot of people are going to think of it as a holiday book, and well, they'll be in for a surprise, won't they?
So I was curious if you've always been a fan of Scrooge or maybe Dickens, or if this is not an idea that came out of necessarily your adoration of the author, but something else.
Well, you know, my first novel was called Finn, and it was the secret history of Huck Finn's father.
Yeah.
And that really did come from a very early experience of reading Huck when I was just a boy and didn't have any adult supervision and was completely overwhelmed by the terror of that character. Marley is sort of a different animal in a way. The novel kind of leapt into being for me, not from the young John, but from John of 2018, who was living through, who was living through the Trump era.
Right.
An era in which nothing is as it seems, reality ceases to exist, and lies become truth and night becomes day and up becomes down, where every transaction is a fraud. And I was thinking about that. And I was thinking about the idea that, of course, the publishing world does like writers who, while not, I wouldn't say repeating myself, and I would never repeat myself. And that's a problem for me in a way. The writer who won't write the same book six times sometimes fails to sell anything except the first one.
People are very comforted by what they're already familiar with, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
And the thought occurred to me that it might be an interesting experiment to try to do again what I had done with Finn. And was thinking about various other characters in literature whose stories have appealed to me and whose stories have been sort of untold. And Jacob Marley appeared to me as he did to Ebenezer Scrooge. There's so little of him. And, he's transparent to begin with. There's not much. We know that he was a wicked individual, that he was in some way, because he's carrying these chains. He says, these are the chains, I bear the chains that I forged in life. We can suspect that he was probably, that the root of his evils, or at least one root, had to do with money, the way that Scrooge's evils come from money. We know they were in business together. We don't know what business they were in.
Right.
We know so little about him. We know that Scrooge and Marley, the company, had a warehouse and an accounting operation. And that's the sum total of it. So I began to think, well, what would be interesting about Jacob Marley would be to be able to chart a course for him and also chart a course for Scrooge through their lifetime together.
Right.
And find out or explore or manufacture, however you want to say it, what made Marley Marley, and along the way, how did Marley help contribute to making Scrooge Scrooge?
Yeah.
Because the thing about Scrooge, of course, is that we don't know a lot. We know of a few little tiny scenes shown to us by the Ghost of Christmas Past, but we do know that he had a fiancée. Her name was Belle.
Right.
And that she broke it off because she said he'd grown too obsessed with money. He was too greedy. Well, that right there indicates that there must have been a time when he was otherwise.
Yeah.
And Dickens tells us nothing about that.
Well, I think Dickens only mentions Belle's name once, right, in the book?
Actually, she appears twice.
Oh, twice.
She appears at the dance in Old Fezziwig's store.
Right.
She's there. She's working with Ebenezer for Old Fezziwig. And every time I picture Old Fezziwig, I'm sorry, I picture Fozzie the Bear. I can't.
Now we all will.
And now we all will, because there's so many takes on A Christmas Carol, but we'll get to that. And also there is a scene where she breaks it off with him.
Yes.
And we don't know exactly what the context is, but we just see the two of them together. And she gives him this little painful lecture about what he's become and says that their engagement is through. So I thought it would be interesting to try to see what kind of a man he might have been to make her fall in love with him.
Yeah.
And then to lose that. So that was, and I couldn't, of course, call, it's only, as I couldn't call the book Scrooge because all kinds of other things have been called Scrooge. And Marley was to me the heart of the story.
Yeah.
Because he's the unknown. And it's a book that kind of charts a course where Scrooge goes from a little more open-hearted. We get the chance to see him in love, and we see him harden. And we actually see Marley go through, belatedly, a kind of repentance and epiphany. So their stories cross.
Yeah. Now, in your acknowledgments, you thank Dickens for, among other things, leaving holes in the original narrative for you to fill and build on. And I got to thinking about that, and I wondered if you think that might have had to do with the nature of this work, which was, I believe that it was published in weekly installments in magazines, and it offered cliffhangers, but maybe, you know, the nature of getting people to come back is to not tell the full story, is to kind of leave little pieces unexplained. Do you think that had anything to do with it?
That's a nice take on it. Dickens, of course, was one to leave as few holes as possible because he was paid by the word.
Oh, right.
In fact, I got a nice letter the other day from a fellow who's written some books about Dickens, who said he marveled at the fact that Marley felt like an entire Dickens novel, the width and the breadth and the length, even though it's less than 300 pages long.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's a pretty good compliment.
What a nice compliment. Exactly. Yeah.
Back to your main question or your idea, which I think is a good one. Of course, every story, every novel, every movie has holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I kind of liken it to a film going through a projector. You see little square bits of it that you're shown in quick succession until you believe that something's actually happening. There's always a hole in a novel because you can't see the whole world. But yeah, he certainly, well, Dickens needed money very badly when he wrote A Christmas Carol.
Okay.
And by God, it's paid off for a lot of people as time has gone by. But the thing about it, as you say, man, there was that cliffhanging thing. It was short, so he didn't tell much about, you know, the history of Scrooge. Scrooge really, this may seem sacrilegious, but Scrooge is hardly more than a puppet. You know, he's hardly more than a cardboard cutout representing greed.
Yeah.
We know so little about him that he's really not fleshed out in the way that many Dickens characters are. And that's sort of a trick of the eye.
Yeah.
You know, he gives us enough.
Yeah.
And Marley, he didn't give us anything. All he gave us about Marley was that, you know, Marley was sort of like the reel that you, or the rope that you pull to start the lawnmower. He was just a kickstarting device to get this thing in motion to say, oh boy, there's going to be a ghost story here, boys and girls.
Right.
And here's the first one. So yeah, he just, it was more a sketch and the shortness of it, I think does reflect A, the way it was published, B, the speed at which it was written and so forth. Yeah, I think you're right.
Now, I loved what you did with Marley's story and how you made it your own. And I want to talk a little bit about the business that they're in. Is that fine with you? I don't think it's much of a spoiler. It's all,
yep.
It's all out there. But so entangling...
No, because we don't know in Dickens what business they're in at all.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so entangling Marley and Scrooge, mainly by association, but also he understands what his work is, they're entangled in the slave trade. And that is just so right to me. I mean, apart from the fact that it's got this metaphor with the chains going on, I thought that is so perfect and historically accurate as far as England abolishing the slave trade. And just this strikes me as uniquely yours. And I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. When did that idea come to you? Were you already working on the book?
That came to me pretty early.
Did it?
In fact, very, very early. I hadn't even started writing. And I'm not a guy who does an awful lot of preparation. You know, my preparation for writing about Scrooge and Marley was that I've read A Christmas Carol 50 times, you know, or not 50 times, but a dozen times. And I've read other Dickens novels on end, and I love Dickens. And so, you know, I didn't really need to think too hard about getting the facts straight, but the first question I wanted to answer was that question of what line of work were they in? And, you know, it seemed likely, I think my assumption has always been, probably everyone's assumption has always been, that they were in some kind of shipping or, you know, the movement of merchandise somehow. And in fact, my wife and I were talking about it, and the notion came up of the slave trade. And wouldn't it be awful if these two were slavers? And yeah, you're correct in that, in terms of that being kind of my particular thing. It's a subject you don't hear about in Dickens, although it was going on. I can't think of particular references to it in Dickens's work. It certainly refers to my first novel, Finn, which was all about slavery.
Sure.
So when it occurred that that slavery might be their line of work, then I began to do the actual research that actually counted in the book, which was looking into the chronology of the slave trade in Britain. And sure enough, once I began to put timelines together and figure out their ages, of course, their ages are kind of malleable based on how old we figure Scrooge might be in A Christmas Carol. So there was some wiggle room there. So I picked some dates and began to plot out what age they would be here and what age they would be there. And sure enough, their maturity in business, say when they were in their late 30s or so, would have been around the time 1807, which is when when Britain abolished the slave trade and the shipping of slaves. And by God, suddenly that opened everything up for me.
Right. Yeah.
What if they were, we were already thinking, you know, I was already thinking, Marley and Scrooge are in the slave trade. Maybe Marley knows more about it than Scrooge does, because I was working on what kind of a character he would be, and I decided that they would be very different instead of being very too much two peas in a pod. Mm-hmm. I wanted Scrooge to be the numbers guy and Marley to be the sort of salesman, and the manipulator, the fraudster, the con man. And I thought, boy, oh boy, it would be interesting if they had all their money in the slave trade and then something happened that caused, you know, that caused the end of that, or that caused the or caused that suddenly to be criminal, in which case we certainly had all the all the wickedness we could possibly desire for our Jacob Marley.
Yeah. Now, the other reason I think this is sort of uniquely yours and would be is that Dickens, for all that he championed the downtrodden, he mainly championed domestic downtrodden. And I don't believe that he was a supporter of foreigners and immigrants. In fact, I think he was sort of outspoken about his dislike of immigrants and foreigners. Yeah. And I know that's not the same thing as slaves, but I'm curious what you think of that.
Well, it connects in a way. I bought the big giant most recent biography of Dickens about 6 years ago and gave up about halfway. Oh, well, I shouldn't confess that. At any rate, yeah, I'm sure you're correct. He was certainly the great champion, the literary champion of the poor and the outcast. But they were our poor and our outcasts.
Exactly. Yeah, and actually, I don't think that he was against immigrants. The thing I really remember from reading a biography myself a while ago was that he used to really complain about the people who were playing music in the streets, and they tended to be, you know, immigrants that couldn't make a living, and they would bother him while he was writing.
Right. Yeah.
So he wasn't very supportive.
You know, this is so interesting to me, because I think back to Twain. I mean, and they were contemporaries.
Right.
In fact, Mark Twain's first date with the woman who would become his wife, Livy, the two of them went to see Dickens read, and he wrote an essay about it. But Twain, for all of his well-known and very real affection for and understanding of and sympathy with Black America, hated Irish people. He just did. And in fact, most scholars who think hard about Finn and Huckleberry Finn think that that character was merely shorthand for a drunken Irishman. And he always had Irish maids, and he fired them one after another, accusing them of drinking his bourbon and so forth. You know, he was awful on that subject. So there you go. There's the two of them side by side.
Now, John, one thing I loved about Marley is that the narrative seems to know its own future in a way. And I enjoy that because all the readers know the future of these characters. They know it very, you know, it's just, it's part of our culture, their future. Do you mind if I read a couple little quotes?
Sure.
So at one point when he's putting off his sister who wants him to come to a social event, the narrative states about Scrooge, he has even now begun to adopt the work habits that will serve the enterprise of Scrooge and Marley so very well and for so very long. So, I mean, that's very familiar to us. We know that he's going to be working with Marley. And then a bit later, a colleague mentions that Scrooge and Marley are not to be separated. And the narrative explains that he says this as if the two businessmen are doomed to be joined together, not just in this world, but forever and ever. Even into the afterlife, even unto the extinguishing of the last sulfurous ember of the last burning chunk of brimstone mustered up by Old Scratch himself. I just loved that. So there are 2 points. I feel like this is really fun for the reader to kind of just see these little, it's like I said before, readers are comforted by what they are already familiar with, to see these little mentions of what's going to come, not in your narrative, but in Dickens. But also, it must have made your job easier as the author to be able to assume that we know the future and read eagerly toward it. Does that make sense?
It's funny. One of the things that I really like about a book like Marley in particular, is that people don't have to worry about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It completely eliminates that. Which is a thing that a lot of people read books for. You know, they read books to find out what happens and, you know, what becomes of this person. Does he die in the end? Is he victorious over his quest? Whatever it is. They don't need to think about that with Marley because he's going to die. The question they have to think about, and see, this is where I think we kind of get to the difference between sort of commercial fiction or genre fiction and what gets called literary fiction, which is what this generally gets called, is that you get to worry about the nature of the character and his soul and how what's going to happen will happen and why. So it's the similar kind of anticipatory reading, but it's for slightly different reasons, and it makes things operate on a different level. It puts plot into the background in some ways, and puts character into the foreground, and that suits me just fine.
Yeah, that's a great explanation.
It was funny. My wife and I just got done watching over a period of two nights, I guess. I guess we did it in two nights. Martin Scorsese's new movie, The Irishman.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's about Jimmy Hoffa and the hitman, Frank Sheeran, who worked for him and for the mob. And when it got started, my wife, Wendy, turns to me and said, "This is just like Marley. We know how it's going to end." And she's right. And that's what lets Scorsese in that movie fill up 3.5 hours with character, not with plot, because we know Hoffa's going to get it in the neck, but we want to know why. We want to know what's in these people's hearts.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I just loved reading this book. I loved the prose, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about finding your own 19th century voice, because you did it really well. So what did you do in order to find that?
Thank you for that. I thank you for that question for a number of reasons.
Okay.
I may not get around to answering the question. I will, however, provide a few versions of a thank you for the question.
Okay.
The first version is a lot of readers aren't cautious enough or skilled enough or experienced enough or sensitive enough or whatever to detect that I'm not trying to do an impression of Charles Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
And by no means am I doing an impression of Charles Dickens. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One is that I wouldn't be able to do it well. But that is probably not the primary one. The primary one would be if American readers wanted to read Charles Dickens these days, they'd read more Charles Dickens. I don't think they want that. Right. That kind of writing is hard to read. And it's different, and it teaches them different things, and it appeals to different things. So that would have been a bad idea. So I appreciate the fact, you know, the recognition that this is a 19th century voice that doesn't belong to anybody in particular except me. It's not Dickens. It's not Twain. It's more like Twain than it is like Dickens, actually, I think. But it's not like Twain either. And it's certainly not like Melville. You know, it's a whole different animal. It's quite modern in a way. Oh, but the next thank you for recognizing that voice is an important thing and a thing that can be and must be invented. An awful lot of people who are trying to write and trying to learn to write and learning to write, get the idea, and they're told this by people who should know better, that they need to find their voice.
Right.
Finding of your voice is total malarkey to my way of thinking. And I don't want to sound like Joe Biden, but it's it's baloney. It's what most people seem to mean, in my experience, by finding their voice means getting comfortable with the way they naturally do things.
Okay.
And claiming it as their own. And I think that's weak and limiting and not helpful to anyone. I hadn't ever put this thought together before. Right now, I'm a guitar player and other things. And my favorite musician from my childhood, he died about 10, 15 years ago, is a guy named John Hartford. He played the banjo and the fiddle. He wrote Gentle on My Mind. He was a great compendium of American folk music. And he once said, famously to me, not to me, but it was famous to me, the following sentence: style is based on limitation.
Huh.
And I love it. And it's true. And he also said that he wished toward the end of his life that he could go back and play every single note he had ever played, knowing what he knew then.
Huh.
And there's power and wisdom in that. And the idea that you can only play the things that you have the skill to play. That is, you can only write the sentences that you have acquired the skill to write is hugely important. And so writers who can manage, and there are lots of them, there are guys who, you know, sort of like some actors manage just to be themselves all the time, and they've found their one thing. You know, I think of Cormac McCarthy, who was grand, but he's always he always sounds the same, and that's fine. I think of Elmore Leonard. You know, mm-hmm. I think of then you think of William Faulkner, who could do anything.
Right.
And I think it's nicer to be able to do anything. And that means for one book, you may want to invent one voice, and for the next book, you might want to invent another voice, and they have to serve the story. Like an actor talks about, Harrison Ford always talked about his job was to serve the story. So a voice has to serve the story. And in this case, it had to fool you into seeming like it was antique, but it had to support some very modern ideas. It had to support Scrooge and Bell and then Marley and Fan as they went through their playing around at love and courtship. Right. In a very modern way. It had to support an awareness of the kind of fraud that we see around us all today and it had to support all kinds of very modern things, but it had to sound like it had been around for a while it was doing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know what the secret is to that. But that was sort of the objective.
Let's see. I'm trying to find it. Do you mind if I read just a short paragraph? This is.
I love it.
Okay. So I feel like to me, this was just lovely, first of all, no matter what century it's supposed to come from. But I think this sort of tells me how you wrote this book. It's contemporary, but it feels old. Okay. This is from a party or a ball that they've all gone to, the four of them.
On Christmas Eve.
On Christmas Eve, right. And this is, I think, from Marley's point of view. Well, sort of. It's not really. Okay, so just as dancers move according to fixed and long-established symmetries, so those on the periphery behave according to certain principles and patterns. They swirl, gather, separate, and coalesce again and again, following eddies and currents imperceptible to any but the most observant. And then it goes on, and we learn that Marley is observant in this way, and that's why he's so good at business, but also at people and at manipulating people.
Right.
But anyway, I loved that. I thought it was just beautiful that just to think about how these people are swirling like water, which also ties into, you know, other themes in the book of shipping and boats and water. And I don't know, maybe that's taking it too far, but
I don't think he's taking it too far.
Oh, good. You know, there are other moments that are like that, where it's just, the language is quite beautiful. It's not exactly of this time, but I don't know what time it is necessarily from, but I loved it.
See, that's the thing. It's not, it doesn't sound like most any book you pick up in the airport.
Which is fine.
A skiing buddy of mine told me the other day, your books are the kind of books you might get assigned in high school. And I thought, well, I don't know about that, but you know, there's a respect for the old ways, and that the bit that you read is certainly a good example of a lot of things. I mean, there's alliteration, right. there's a musical rhythm to it.
Yes,
there's rhyme. There are words that rhyme. There's all kinds of stuff built in there that all works together to build up, you know, alliteration is like the rhythm, is like the beat, and there's music going on in the background, and there's these words that rhyme, and there's it's all built to feel right, to feel like motion. And if there's ever a well, I make a lot of mistakes, as do we all, but if there's ever a mistake that I'm prone to making, it's putting rhythm ahead of anything else.
Oh, well, that's not a terrible mistake. I feel like I feel like that makes a wonderful first draft and can be edited out in revision if it's too much, you know. But to have poetry in your prose is a gift, I think. So, well, one thing that's at absolutely not 19th century like is that this book is written in the present tense. And I was wondering if you could talk about that choice.
I love the present tense. For a lot of reasons.
Okay.
I do. This is a case where it's funny. I mean, how every decision you make affects every other decision. And if you were to take a chunk of Marley and put it in the past tense, it would be different. Not only just because some of the words would sound different, and some would have more or fewer syllables, it would change everything. I like the presence, the immediacy of the present tense, and it's certainly, as you suggest, it's not a thing characteristic of 18th century or whatever writing, to put it in the present tense. Mm-hmm. That's a more modern trick. I find that this is kind of a technical thing, but when you start going back, and I've lost track of what all of the names for these tenses are, but when you start to go back to Marley remembered having thought about when he was, you know, when you start going generations back in the narrative,
past perfect and all that,
to past perfect and I find that I can do that better, and I do that a lot, but I can do that better if I'm starting in the present tense for some reason. It works better for me that way, and I don't know why. Maybe it's one of those limitations that John Hartford was talking about, and maybe that's why I like why I'm drawn toward the present tense. But I do like the immediacy of it, and one thing about it for taking on a story like this, which we know is old, is that it says to the reader, this is new.
Right.
It says, this is now. This is the new information that you're getting, and therefore separates it from the original Dickens.
Let's see. I wanted to talk about, you know, I was curious as I started to read the book if there would be any sort of embedded ghost story here. And
I thought about that, too.
I loved what there is, which is the subtle promise of the ghost story to come from Dickens. And do you mind? I'm going to read a couple more things. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right. So here, this is from quite late in the book. I'm not going to say what's happening in this scene, but the setting is this. The parlor, draped with linens hung to dry, might be either a sailmaker's loft or the scene of a haunting. And that was wonderful. And then this one from earlier in the book, Ebenezer's talking, I believe, with maybe Belle or Fan, I can't remember. There is consolation in his voice, but when he looks up, she can see upon his face the markings of his toil. His brow is seamed, his eyes are sunken, and his hair, drawn back into his customary pigtail, has begun a long retreat from his forehead. He looks to her like the very ghost of himself come back from the future to provide her with a warning. Yeah, I just love it. You know, to me, that is better for this book than to embed yet another ghost story. Do you know what I mean? It was just, it's very haunting, but it's haunting because of what we know to expect, as I sort of said already before. But
I decided the only ghost that this book needed was you know, the death of Marley. You know, was his transformational dying moment.
Yeah.
And that had to wait until the last page. But yeah, those are good examples. That one of the where the room could either be a sailmaker's loft or the scene of a haunting. I mean, that pulls together everything once again there. I mean, it's transit, it's slave ships, and it's A Christmas Carol. I mean, it's ghosts and everything else.
Right, but there's also that scene from A Christmas Carol where women are stealing the bed linens off the sides of the bed in which Ebenezer died.
Yes, yes.
To me, this felt very much like a nod to that scene, too.
It's all in there.
Yeah. Did you look at the drawings by John Leech in creating the looks of the characters? I suppose I shouldn't say that because Dickens, of course, wrote their physicality into his novel. But I always sort of liked those drawings, too.
You know, I never did.
Okay.
I never did. If I looked at any drawings of the characters, there's a – do you know the great Massachusetts-based woodcut artist named Barry Moser?
I do not.
Oh, his work is fantastic.
Oh, okay.
I have it's called the Penny Royal Press edition of Huckleberry Finn, where he did glorious illustrations. And in fact, I met him a few years ago, and he confessed that he said, if I had read Finn before I did the illustrations for Huckleberry Finn, they would be very different.
Oh, how funny. Wow.
In fact, Barry and I have stayed in touch, and he had some rough drawings that he had been executing for an illustrated edition of A Christmas Carol that he shared with me, which were interesting too. I had this idea that we might be able to get the publisher to do a frontispiece by Barry for the book, but that didn't pan out. But you know, there's always a paperback. We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, that would be fun because there always were illustrations in Dickens magazine. Let's see. Oh, I wanted one more craft question, and then I have a couple of other things. But I wondered if you enjoyed writing the setting of London in this time period, and if you can talk about maybe what you drew on to create the setting.
Let me see. I drew on having read so many Dickens novels over my lifetime, and I love them all. When I was in seventh grade, my seventh grade English teacher, this was her last year of teaching, and her first year of teaching, she had had my dad. Mrs. Laughlin had us, believe it or not, seventh grade, read all of A Tale of Two Cities aloud.
Oh, my.
So that goes back. Maybe I owe her this book. I'm not sure.
Did you do that in class as a group?
In class.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. And that's a big book.
Yeah.
So, but you know, all that time of reading Dickens was an awful lot of what I needed internally to be able to do what I like to do, which is to not do too much.
Okay.
I always think it's important to get, how can I put it? In a book like this, I'm not really trying to evoke London in 1807. I'm trying to evoke Charles Dickens' London in 1807.
Okay.
And trigger those memories that we all have of the thing that he has already shown us. So that makes the job a little easier and a little different. And I figure if I can get a certain number of small things that, you know, and there are so many memorable images and sights and so forth in A Christmas Carol, you know, if you can get the clanging of the clocks in the steeple, and if you can get the foggy streets and you know, you can get those things right, then everybody, you know, the reader can fill in a lot of the rest. There was one good example, though, of where research, a couple things where research helped me out. There is a wedding that takes place in a chapel that I did some research to get all that stuff right, and found all kinds of interesting things that I was sort of symbolic things that I was able to work with. And I did have an idea that I needed to know how many horses there were on the streets of London in 1800.
Okay.
And I found it on the internet. yeah, that's a lot of horses, and it was a whole lot of. The idea was that I wanted to give you an idea of how much horse manure there might be out there.
Yeah,
and sure enough, there was I forget the number, but there was a lot of horses.
Yeah,
but that kind of detail, if you can say there were 10,000 horses, dray horses, you know, blah 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 blah. If you can fill that in, that speaks to people and gives them just enough. If you do that too much, then your book is just lump after lump of research, and I hate that.
Yeah. I remember interviewing Anita Diamant. She wrote the book, uh-huh, The Red Tent, and I remember her saying, you know, at a certain point, Melville, you know, is rendering too much blubber.
Now that's a sacrilege.
So I wondered, because this book does have a little bit of a nod to the whaling industry. Is Ahab next? You mentioned Melville.
Well, you know, I think you might be onto something, and I won't take it any further than that.
Okay.
I've always been a huge Melville fan. And in fact, this is kind of a craft answer to an unasked question. The references, well, of course, not everybody recognizes this, and when you do, it's fun. There are two characters in the book who are not really characters; they're false identities that Marley cooks up, and they are two Quaker gentlemen from Nantucket.
Nantucket, right.
Yeah, their names are Bildad and Peleg. And those are the two gentlemen who owned the Pequod.
Ah.
Yeah, so there is a distinct Melville, very clear Melville reference there. And what else this leads me to is that the very first novel I ever wrote, I wrote six novels before I finally wrote Finn and found somebody that would be interested in publishing it. My first novel was what I described completely fearlessly as my tragicomic whaling book. And no wonder nobody wanted it. But it did contain some characters that actually swam back over and got involved in Marley. This is like 20 years later. There were two characters, Captain Grommet and his first mate, Mr. Flea. Boy, are those Dickensian names.
They were
straight from that first novel, as was Valentino Monteverdi.
Oh, okay.
The individual who really sets in motion the financial warfare between Scrooge and Marley.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and he's also a funny little character.
He is, and he's very fond of Fan.
He does like Fan. He likes all the ladies.
Let's see. Okay, I wanted to ask you, John, what are you reading lately that you might recommend to listeners, other people's books that you might recommend?
I read a lot of nonfiction. I'm right now in the middle of a book called A False Report by T. Christian Miller and Kent Armstrong.
Okay.
Which is about a series of rape cases in Colorado and Seattle. It was the basis for a Netflix series called Unbelievable.
Oh yeah, I've seen that series.
It's real. Read the book. It's called A False Report. It's very good.
Okay.
I just two other things. My house Atria sent me a copy a few weeks ago of a terrific book that's coming out in the spring by a British writer. I think she's British, might be Irish, named Jess Kidd. And the book is called Things in Jars. That was huge fun. My editor said, I think you'll like this. And he seems to know me pretty well, because I did. Things in Jars by Jess Kidd. And then there's the book that I always recommend from Charles Frazier, Mr. Cold Mountain.
Yeah.
This book came out probably 10 years ago, and it's my favorite of his books. It's a brilliant piece of work. It's called Nightwoods. Nighthwoods.
Okay.
It's a literary thriller. You hear sometimes things described as a literary thriller, and oftentimes they're neither thrilling nor literary. but I tell you, Frazier nails both. It's a beautiful and really compelling book.
Okay, wonderful. So we kind of played around with this, but what are you able to talk about what you're writing next, or are you not sure yet, or are you not wanting to talk about it yet?
I have two partials that I'm sitting on right now. I don't know which way it's going to go. One is in the way of another novel in the mold of Finn and Marley, a minor character in a very well-known story, and how he gets into the trouble he gets into.
Okay.
I always like to write about people who make really bad decisions, and this guy makes some really bad ones. And the other is Melville related.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know. I was just talking about both of them with my agent the other day, and I'm sort of simmering in this place in between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Yeah.
And I don't know which way I'm gonna end up going.
Will there be cannibals?
I don't think so.
Oh.
I don't think so.
I always liked Melville's cannibals. So I have one last question for you, John, and that is, I wonder if you, I always like to ask my guests for advice for writers, and I wonder in your case if you have any advice for developing a story from a character that you've, a found character, I'll say, and that could be from somebody else's book or from a photograph, an obituary, a family legend, whatever, you know, developing a character that you find and want to expand on.
My advice would be, and this is my advice, not necessarily good advice, but my advice would be to be honest and respectful and as resourceful as possible, but don't transgress the bonds and the bounds of the original story so as to conflict with it. It's very easy to say, well, we're going to take this character and we're going to clean him up. Mm-hmm. And we're going to show that he was, you know, misunderstood, or what we saw of him in this other place wasn't correct, or was a mistake. Take the material that you get as if it's gospel truth.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's the only way you can build something that I think is meaningful. So, for example, in terms of Marley, I was able to kind of, in some ways, you could say, present a kinder, gentler Scrooge, but that is not in conflict with what Dickens gave us. As long as he ends up when we first meet him, as long as at every one of the moments where we see him with the Ghost of Christmas Past, he is the man that we see there.
Yeah.
And as long as at the end of my book, he is the man who enters into A Christmas Carol, everything else is fair.
Yeah.
But you can't violate the original. You shouldn't violate. I don't believe in violating the original. Therefore, this book was really easy in a lot of ways for that, because it was so wide open relative to Marley. As long as he was, cruel and bitter or cruel and evil. And as long as at the end, because you got to remember at the beginning of A Christmas Carol, he shows up. I mean, he's dragging these chains through the afterlife, and he goes somehow out of his way to come to Ebenezer Scrooge's room and try to save his soul.
Yeah.
He must have been a bad man. We're told that he was a bad man, but is it just the punishment he's getting that makes him want to save his soul, or was there something else? Yeah. Which could be, which once again can be entirely true to the book, but give you a whole different look at it.
Yeah.
I think of it the way I think of now that I think about it. This has been occurring to me a lot lately, and I've been talking about movies sometime in here a bit. How actors prepare for a role. And they have to envision, one of the practices is to envision a life for the character beyond these moments. And I've been talking with the fellow who did the review of Marley in the New York Times, a fellow named Simon Callow, the British actor and Dickens expert.
Okay.
And he's done a one man Dickens stage thing in London and a one man Christmas Carol. And his remark was, that many people who want to play, Jacob Marley, if they read this book ahead of time, will see him differently.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But it's not unfair.
Another compliment, really.
And that's a pretty, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And that's the idea. If you can make some, because it's new. I mean, Marley is a new story.
Yeah.
About a very bad man and a weak man who become the characters that enter into A Christmas Carol on the, when you turn the page. But it is new.
Now, can you just repeat the quote by John Hartford that you mentioned before?
Style is based on limitation.
Right. Okay. So it's interesting because you were saying that it was easier for you to write from this work because you had to stay within the limitations of what Dickens offered us, right? And so that just that reoccurred to me when you were saying that. So
sure, yeah. And the other way to look at that is that as a writer, my strength is not in plotting. I remember, I don't know if you remember the great American writer John Hawkes. He used to, author of The Blood Oranges and The Frog. He used to claim, he used to claim that plot and character are the enemy of the modern novel. And in my case, plot is, so I'm kind of with him on the plot thing, in as much as it's not the thing that interests me the most. What interests me is the souls of these characters. So it is a nice So that's a limitation of mine. Mm-hmm. And that kind of limits the things that I'm the kind of stories that I'm going to be able to tell. And a way to accommodate that, rather than become a guy who's good at plotting, which just does not interest me, is to say, okay, here's the end of the story. Let's throw it into the pond and swim down to it, because let's just get that bit out of the way, because I'm not good at keeping you in suspense about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I get that. Well, I want to mention again, the name of the book is Marley, a novel by John Clinch, and it is published by Atria Books. John, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you about Marley. I really enjoyed this book so much, so thank you.
Thank you. It's been a delight to talk to you and to be able to address such good questions. I really appreciate it.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author John Clinch. His recent novel is Marley, published by Atria. You can learn more about his work at johnclinch.com. That's J-O-N. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider the quote from John Clinch's favorite folk musician, the banjo player John Hartford: style is based on limitation. Consider how this idea might apply to your own work and let it help you decide, what are your strengths? What are your limitations? Are these in fact helping you rein in the scope of your project, or should they? In other words, would it be helpful to focus on your strengths as you've recognized them and let go of certain goals that are perhaps overambitious given your limitations? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm going to try to say this without getting upset. I had to put my dog to sleep yesterday. It's very sad, and I just want to encourage all of you to let your pets know you love them. And if you don't have pets, let somebody else know you love them. All right, have a great week.